said?
He said that whatever's left, we can have. I got to figure out five. Actually, I got one more. I don't know quite how much.
I haven't gone through one yet.
Really?
I gave like bullet points and stuff to some people to work on, and they made it for me, and I didn't go through it.
But
I had the thoughts of what I wanted to kind of.
So you probably have a nice slide. I just got ops guy slide.
No. Mine is ops. I do have one.
All right, we're ready to go. If you guys could take your seats, please.
So, those guys.
We do too, but they only want us to do stuff for them. So they don't do stuff for us. We don't have that. We're not saying that. Huh?
All right, good afternoon. As mentioned earlier, I'm Brian Kira with Harvest Consumer Products, part of pulling this together, so hopefully you like the remainder of the event. Just one quick public service announcement. We have Thursday afternoon at 3, there's a session on new products and services, and we've had three affiliate companies want to come and share some of the things that are going on for the broader group, and we've got room for one more, so thanks to Reliance Packaging, CompTech, and LoadScan. They'll all be presenting on Thursday. And if anyone wants to just get up, open mic, 15 minutes, talk about cool things that are going on within your company, please see me, see Shelley, and hopefully we can find one more to fill out that session. For this session, we thought it would be a neat idea. I don't know if it's been done. It probably has been after 46 years, but putting together a little panel. And so we've got three industry companies. Each of these companies is represented in the board here. And they each came to talk about something that they're passionate about. So I think we're calling the session Improving Operational Excellence, but it's just a good industry discussion. You know, they 15, 20 minutes of talk from each of them, and then they will we'll have an open Q&A at the end of it. So if you're dying to ask a question in the middle, feel free, but there will be a Q&A towards the end. So let me start by just introducing Ken Allen. Ken was kind enough to volunteer to talk about kind of operational efficiency, taking cost out. He was recommended by Bob, and he said yes and is joining us today. So thanks for being here. Chris Littlefield, who obviously you guys know. He's big into planning. He wants to talk about demand planning. And then Brent Bolton, who I work with. We work with a service of contract manufacturers, so he's going to talk a little bit about that world. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ken.
Hey, Ken.
Thank you, and good evening, and welcome to Nashville. Great place if you hadn't been down here in Broadway. Great place. I can recommend that. Volunteering is not exactly right. Bob called me and asked me to do this, and Bob's been a great friend of mine probably for 20 years, and he's been great for the mulch business. And so with all the mulch and soil council, with all directors, but we got great leadership in Bob, and I'd absolutely, as bad a speaker as I am, I could not turn down Bob's request for me to do this. So so volunteer is not exactly right, but appreciation is. So I just, for those of you that don't know me, I'm Ken Allen, and we started our business in 1979 in Hope, Arkansas, home of Slick Willie. So in all the years, we enjoyed that part of that. Of course, we was more famous than Slick Willie until he was president, and so that went downhill. But my life started really in my father owned a small little country store in just south of Hope in a little community called Silver Springs, and I grew up watching him service his customers and look after them, and we had gas pumps and took care of them, so I learned at an early age how to deal with customers and how important it was to have that customer and deal with them. At the same time, as we'd get product in, he'd mark it up, and you know, it's pretty easy. Here's your invoice, and here's the markup. But the biggest thing I learned from my father at the time was he hated debt. When I was 10 years old, I understood that debt was bad. And so I grew up in that little setting with watching my father pay everything that came into that store, whether it be gas or groceries or whatever, in cash or with checks people had given him. So early age was no debt. As I got a little older, got me cars and whatever happened, whatever else happens when you're about 17 in South Arkansas. So I still had the same, you know, it's all about saving the money and buying the car and not financing it and whatever. I'll get to my point here in a minute as I ramble, but then as we, you know, found the love of my life and we got married, she probably wouldn't say that, but we lived the whole system the same way. No debt, except finally a house and house payments and things like that. As we started Hope Agri, we had the same attitude. Myself and Tom Duncan and one other guy started the company, and we bought him out early on. But we both had the same attitude. If we could not buy something and pay for it in 18 months about what we were doing already, in other words, as we expanded into some other areas, if we couldn't pay for it in 18 months from what we were already producing and buying, we left it alone. I get to that point because in 1979, when we started our business in February of 79, some of you, this is way early than for your year, but interest rates were at a straight 10% and had been for, I guess, 10 years. Somebody else in here may know the answer to that, but 10% was just standard interest rate. Diesel fuel was 42 cents a gallon in February of 79. By 1980, in the Jimmy Carter days, interest rates then were 21%, and diesel fuel rose to $1 a gallon. We thought we were dead on both cases, but what we didn't realize, it was the best thing that happened to us on both ends. Number one, we were not debt free, but we were close to being debt free, even at an early stage in our business. Then diesel fuel going to $1 a gallon eliminated people coming in the Dallas market that was coming from 500 miles away, because you know trucks were, you know, running for 45 cents or 50 cents a running mile. So all of that being worked in our favor. So as we grew our business, we still grew it at a standard rate of, you know, as we go into what is in Powderly, Texas right now, we were sure we could pay for it from the money we were generating from Hope, and then on down the line as we grew. In my early days, with the only other job I really had was sold John Deere farm equipment. Well, it was kind of like being in the store, you know, because we're coming in and you know what a tractor is. You know, your tractor from John Deere is costing you $20,000, and you set your rate at making 15%, and so you're selling it for, you know, $23,000. So that was pretty simple. As you get into the manufacturing business, then everything changes, because then you have costs coming in that you have no idea what was. Now, 1979 was pretty easy. We were buying bark from sawmills. We were paying $4.25 a ton for pine bark. We were bringing it in within 15 or 20 miles, so we were bringing in maybe for $2 a ton, so we had $6.50 a ton in the bark landed. We didn't have a whole lot to figure. I mean, so we basically started going into the market, and we didn't figure our cost. We didn't know how to figure our costs. So today my point is trying to teach you how to figure your costs. Well, I have no idea how we figured our costs. So we just go out, and here's our we knew what the bark was costing and what the freight was, but what our manufacturing cost, we had no idea. So our sales pitch was not go to the customer and say, here's my cost, I got to make 30% or 20% or whatever that number is. We go to the market and we say, oh, you're paying $1.65 for a 3-cubic foot bag of pine bark moss, we'll sell it to you for $1.60. Now, probably if you look around this room, we're probably all guilty of that even today. We're not basing it on our production costs. We're just basing it on whatever we got to do to beat the competition. So as we go through this, I'm just asking you to, you know, everybody's got a different system of figuring. I know we had a different. We sold to Oldcastle in 2014. You know, a great for us, great for Oldcastle, but. You know, they had a totally different way of figuring their cost. It didn't matter. I mean, we came down to this, you know, pretty close to the same thing. Once we figured our cost, they just had a different system of getting there. And you probably do too. Just are you sure you're getting all your costs figured in there? Freight, you know, freight can change, as we all know, in a matter of 2 weeks or 2 months. High's gone way up, way down, back up. Resin bags. Are we prepared for that? Are we prepared for the cost of the pallets, shortage of pallets and whatever? Are we prepared for all the regulations that we have to live by and do? Are we prepared for a loader fire or a fire at a plant where you burn up $100,000 worth of loaders or you burn up $100,000 worth of raw material? Are we figuring that in? You probably are. You may be figuring it different than your neighbor or whatever. But your production costs are there. And as we go into the market, are we, you know, what are we gambling? Are we gambling we're not going to have a loader fire? Are we gambling we're not going to have a engine blow up that's going to cost us $50,000? You know, I remember some of the first days in dealing with Caterpillar. We had Caterpillar equipment, and the first time I ever remember them charging me a service call to come fix a 920 Caterpillar, I get this huge bill for travel. And it wasn't but then wasn't but $150. My colleague, well, I said, what is this? He said, we gotta figure our cost, and that's what it's costing us. Of course, now any dealer out to work on a loader, just his travel time alone sometime is as much as your bill, as much as your repairs are gonna be. So are we prepared for that? What are you willing to gamble? You know, like, you know, I think I loved a lot of the vices as I was growing up, but gambling was also one of them. But what you know, how much are you going to gamble, take money out of your pocket and put it in the pot when the pot is big or if it's little? Your cost of manufacturing can get away from you, and how you're figuring that, again, is individually up to you. If you look around this room, I know, as I see now, just being from the mulching soil years ago, there's some people, a lot of people are not here. When we first started doing business with Walmart in 1986, we went to we'd go to a meeting every year to a little summit, and there would be like 40 vendors for the whole United States for Walmart. It'd be like this. It'd be 100 people there. It'd be 2 or 3 people per vendor. Now you look around, the last Walmart meeting I went to, I knew one guy that had been there, you know, more than 5 years. So a lot of people, if you look around the room, if you look down the list of mulch suppliers that were in business 20 years ago are not here. It's either they lost business, selling below their cost, or riding around in Cadillacs and airplanes. So which one are we? So that's all I got, and I'm going to give it to Chris, I guess. And
Thank you.
Pardon?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh boy. I may need some help. This is an apple. Huh? That one? Okay. That one. That one, Bob? That one. It's not working. There it goes. Cool. All right. So first of all, the program bills some of us as experts, and I'm not going to try and tell you that I'm an expert in this subject matter whatsoever. I feel like maybe collateral damage or someone that just because of what we have to accomplish, we all have to deal with inventory in one way or another. So, you know, my passion isn't inventory so much. I think my passion is, like the other people in this room, is that this part about don't running out. It's cultural. It's genetic. It's in our DNA. We have a very short window of time to make hay while the sun shines. We have tenuous relationships, hard to build relationships with our customers, really easy to mess up if we run out. So this part of production planning to meet sales demand is about not running out. Well, you know, I think we're all very highly aligned on that and get very, very uncomfortable when the truck shows up and we don't have something to put on it. Not something any of us like to have to explain. On the other hand, every extra dollar that's in inventory can be used for something else. So we don't want to have too much either, do we? At the same time, we're typically working with a forecast that we don't particularly trust, may not have reason to trust. We're maybe working with tools on a long continuum from maybe QuickBooks to something that you've had built for you, and maybe the people that are running the colossal SAPs and Oracles, all that. But all in all, you may not trust the tools that you have to work with. You may not trust your vendors particularly well in terms of their ability to trust on time, too. So this part about not having too much, I would say, of those first two, as an industry, we probably really relaxed that first one a whole bunch. What I'm going to be talking about is really, again, as not an expert, but as someone who is part of an organization where what we've been doing, we found hasn't been working. And I just want to walk you through how we've done things and then how we're working on doing things here in the future. Part of that is this planning demand, not supply. And that's really all about spending more time in the contemplative thinking part of inventory management, which is grooming demand, using the right tools that use the statistical history information that you have to groom the attributes of the items that you're using so that you have the best information possible about how that item's going to behave over a period of time, typically by location. And even as I say that, because you're using history so much to do that, we know that there are some classic places where that's not even going to begin to work. For instance, new products, new geography, and kind of the classic one for me that drives me crazy as an operations guy is where we have relationships with our customers and they don't particularly care that they've changed what they've decided to promote or which size it is that they're going to promote or that sort of thing. Again, the concept here is to work on the beginning side of planning as opposed to trying to put out fires because you've generated bad information or you use old planning methodologies. In the old days, when I walked into this company in 1999, then when I took this position in 2006, we published one sales revenue budget annually, and we called that a forecast. And we, honest to goodness, one time a year, we made this thing, and we thought that's what we had for operations to plan production, and that's what people had to use to purchase the products as well to support production. And the interesting thing in our company is that another group in the company published this forecast, and regardless of what it said, The operations group was responsible for not running out. Didn't matter how actual demand lined up with this forecast, and I think we probably all still experience that. There's a little craziness to that. It was even crazier that probably until just maybe a year or two ago, I was bought into that. And the poor folks that really end up holding the bag in all of that are the purchasing folks who have very little to work with, and if we run out, it must be their fault. In the old way of doing things, it was every man for himself in terms of planning production at the facilities that we own. Not many of them, three on the West Coast at that time. As we've been expanding, we've been adding people to what we're doing, and that's really what's causing us to rethink how we do things. But it was every facility got to plan what they wanted to do on their own, when they were going to do, how much they were going to do, and it was tribal knowledge. This revenue budget that we published once a year kind of set the tone for whether sales would increase or not, and so the local guy would build that in. But really, the biggest limitation on how much was pre-packed was how much space you had to fill up and what kind of ideas you had about double stacking, whether your neighbors were gone long enough to be able to stack some of your product over on their property till they got home, you know, whatever creative thing you could come up with. And then production, that was for pre-pack, and then production on a day-to-day basis when things got rolling was really using a stock status report. How much is in inventory? How much is picked for shipping? How much is on order? That. So towards the end of the day, every facility for their next couple of shifts would plan production. Well, then the purchasing people were trying to figure out, based on all this, how much to buy. So they had a forecast that really didn't represent anything that was going to happen in each individual item. Production really didn't tell them much about what they were going to do, other than maybe some general information about total quantity of bags that were going to prepack by item, by facility. But they didn't tell them much about the timing. So the purchasing folks would wear coats of rabbit feet, be surrounded by spreadsheets to help them, and Ouija boards trying to figure out how much they should buy to have that ready for production. This is the only chart that we'll look at. I think it's an important one. There's a blue line that represents an annual sales curve for a West Coast company. It's the aggregate of all of the products that sold out of one shipping warehouse or production facility. And then on the left is the total number of units in inventory as time proceeds, as inventories build up in the pre-pack. The blue line, in the way that we used to do things, represents what the purchasing people had to work with in terms of trying to estimate based on the blue line, even as production was taking place to make inventory rise. They only had that information to work with, and that's a huge disconnect, because there needs to be planning in terms of where you need to be inventory level wise. Once you set inventory levels, then you can plan the production to get to those levels. A couple things we know about that blue line: it's the aggregate of all the products at the site. It probably doesn't represent exactly what anything at the site does in terms of its sales, but it has all the pluses and minuses that add up to a pretty good estimation of what's going to happen. And the amazing thing is that in terms of a revenue budget, that is, how much is that facility going to produce and sell over the course of the year, it's amazingly accurate. But in aggregate, but in terms of being able to use it for each product, doesn't work so well. So our fundamental concept, or the vision, has been to develop, implement, and execute a disciplined approach to inventory-related decisions. That is, build processes into the DNA of our company so that they become part of the values, a very deeply ingrained part of the decision-making process. And that process is, again, is to plan demand, not supply. What we're trying to do is, like I said, is put more energy into the front end, the grooming, the having all the pieces in place so that we can put the information into the computer and it can give us relevant, valid information out the back end instead of doing all the work on the back end of trying to estimate what we need. And it's this shift emphasis to this improving our demand estimate. And again, focus on improving item attributes, and then have to incorporate into that vendor performance. So today, we're still creating that revenue budget. We have to because that's the central basis of creating the budget. But we don't use that to do our planning for production and purchasing. It's just a separate animal. What we have done is go out and purchase an ERP system bolt onto ours. We've got an aging ERP system, a couple more years probably of existence at the most. Doesn't do a whole bunch of things well. There are third parties out there that can help you with what I call bolt-ons, things that will do things your current system doesn't do. We went and found one that's a warehouse management system that generates statistical information off the historical data that we've maintained over many, many years on our products. And that is something that we're using to improve our internal operations demand forecast. And then the other important, really important thing here is that we never had before, what I would call a fledgling sales and operations planning feature. I think sales and operation planning is something that should be in the start at the executive level. I can say that in our company, the executive level of the other executives in our company besides me believe that inventory is not a company-wide problem. It's an operations problem. But we still have managed to start this conversation between the sales department and the operations department that's ongoing, so because we have to be able to have external information to put with historical information so that we have the best forecast possible. I just threw in here a little definition of ERP. Enterprise Resource Planning is what that stands for. To me, it's a software that you use every day that never does what you want quite the way you want it to do it. You probably have a host of Excel spreadsheets and maybe access programs linked to that thing that takes the data that you get from that and spits something else out. And you no doubt think that somewhere in cyberspace there really is something out there that'll do everything that you need perfectly. I'm a little dubious about that one. So I'm not a communist, and I'm not in favor of central planning. And we don't centrally plan production for every warehouse every day by any bit of imagination. They are still free at each warehouse to plan their daily production. But what we have done is give these sites guidance in terms of what we know about demand for the month and for the following months and the inventory levels we need to achieve. It would be best if you produce this group of products in this volume. And so, like Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, think of those as guidelines, although we are going to measure to see how close to those numbers you come to see if you're paying attention to the model and using it. We found that, as I mentioned, our ERP system can't even begin to connect inventory levels with production or production constraints. We ended up, fortunately, having someone internally so we could build those Excel spreadsheets and use Access to create our own system that does these pieces for us. And so just reviewing the legacy approach, we just had one chunk of information that was not even remotely granular in terms of the individual products. Everybody had to manually estimate quantities and timing of calculations for production and purchasing. So we had lots of overstocks, lots of stock outs. And the biggest thing there, not a lot of stock outs, but I think the overstocks is the place that this really showed up. It took absolute heroic efforts day after day of the people that did the work to stay in stock. And after a couple of years, they were darn tired of doing it. So we were having a frazzled team. Today, we have the sales analyst who gives information to our analyst who's using the statistical forecast, and we create our forecast to support production planning. We have to define production constraints, which typically are your bulk material processing, packaging throughput, obviously, but then finished goods storage as well, and maybe packaging life you have to take into account there, depending on how well you can protect it or can't. And from that, we plan inventory levels that when we hit those levels, knowing what our other limitations are, we're going to be able to keep up with the sales demand. That production plan, then, is the basis of purchasing, as opposed to the blue line that we looked at before, which was sales, and really disconnected from what's happening. We actually picked that production plan up and run it back through a second edition of our bolt-on that sends the signals for production to the guys that do that, do the production. So I think saying keys to success is a little premature. I should call that keys to progress that we're making, because this is a big deal. I mean, there's a lot of old momentum here that we're turning around, and we really don't have great tools to do it with. But the one thing good about the work that we're doing, as we have an aging ERP system, I think it's going to really help us as we look for the next ERP system, that thing that's supposed to do everything for us when we show up to work. I think it's going to help us make better choices in that part. So as I mentioned, we had people that were in great pain in order to keep in stock and deliver to the customer on time. You know, the politicians say never waste a crisis, and I think the timing in terms of us trying to make changes in our organization is being helped by the fact that people are ready for that change. As I mentioned, we've had to figure out how to use the resources that we have and connect them to other resources, and we're figuring that out. And we've had to invest. We created a new position that we called Master Planner, something that we've never had in our organization. But part of the commitment to change is you have to invest. If you think you're going to make a major change like this and you're going to assign this to somebody that's already busy, good luck. We had to purchase new software, develop our own to connect the pieces. We set expectations. We have a vision. We invited people to get on the bus with a not-so-subtle concept or understanding of what would happen if they didn't get on the bus. But like I said, everybody's ready, and we've had to furnish training. And then, as I said, we've set up some KPIs as well, very, very simple ones at this point. Long term, we expect to see fill rates go up, on-time delivery go up, and inventories fall. That's the classic ideal thing. I would be happy to see inventory happy to see inventory go down, because those our other KPIs are very good at this point. So, in summary, we're shifting our attention to improving our forecast using statistical tools, and we're adjusting that with external knowledge, and that's that S&OP relationship with the salespeople, because if you've only got backwards facing information and an iceberg drifts into the front of you and there isn't somebody up front telling you that, it's probably not going to be a great outcome. We're connecting the production plan methodically with the sales forecast, and we're doing that with consideration of the constraints. And again, we're going around to the front end of the process, paying very close attention to each item's attributes and the supplier's performances, and tying that together with statistical information from history. That's a lot. It's a really really technical conversation, but I can tell you this: if you elect me President of the United States, I will make inventory great again.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. I'm Brent Bolton. I know a lot of you in the room. A lot of you I don't. You know, it's really fun for me to listen to guys that have been doing this for a while, especially since 79. I started in this in 2005. Worked for one of the big national companies, and I got to actually have some colleagues, former colleagues here in the room that have been doing it a long time as well. And we had a guy that was around this from the very beginning and shared a lot of the same kind of stories about how this business grew and what it grew from. And so it's fun to listen to these guys. So I'm here to talk about contract manufacturing, or co-packing as it's called. I started in 05 out on the West Coast, worked out in the same area that Chris is in, and we had our own plants. We had our own network. We had our own network for the most part across the country. So I didn't know anything different. I took a little bit of a hiatus from soil and mulch, went into the grass seed business, and then got back into soil and mulch. When I came back, I went to work for a company that Harvest Consumer Products is our division, that is made up of a number of companies that were bought by a venture capitalist capital company. And it's really been an interesting place to work. What I soon found out that when one of the companies I did know about on the East Coast, Mid-Atlantic, Coastal Supply, that's really who we were. And we were making this transition to be Harvest Power, Harvest Consumer Products, and with these three distinct divisions. And what I found out was that we didn't have that broad network. We didn't have all of our own infrastructure. And about half of our business is working with contract manufacturers and co-packers. It's a really interesting relationship. Your competitors, your stakeholders. This is supposed to be about the expectations of a co-packer, but for me, really, it's both the expectations of a co-packer, but also of the customer, or the, in our case, Harvest. And it's everything in between. You have people that really want the business that you have for whatever reason. Maybe they don't have it. Maybe they're new. Maybe they're in a setback. Maybe they lost a bid. Whatever the circumstances are, and oftentimes you go into those areas and you ask them to be your supplier. So first thing I thought I'd do is, everybody should be familiar with this. When we talk about, Harvest, we want to expand our network. Okay, and we're doing that. We want to do that a number of ways. We want to do that with greenfield sites, eventually acquisitions, co-packers, just a lot. Everything in between. And so, first thing I want to do is kind of say. So if you say you want to have a national network, I won't name who the customers are here, but this is what you're starting to look at, right? So this is just North America. It's about 1,800 stores. And then that's just one big box retailer. And you can overlay the next one, okay? And you can see that it starts to get a little bit more and more of a challenge. It's a big challenge. There's really only one company that operates in that space now, nationally, and they do a good job of it. Different kind of network than we have. And then I thought we would overlay. This is just we started putting everything onto this, right? And pretty soon it just blacked out everything except for the flyover states. And so this is just independents, the Menards and the Aces and those types of companies. So it's a big network. It's a lot of volume. It's a lot of bags, right? It's a complex model. And then we'll take it back to nothing, and then so we can start talking about. So this should look familiar to some people. This is these are sites, so soil and mold sites. And this may not, if you're at a site and you don't see your dot up there, you know, this is always moving. You know, Ken talked about, you know, people come and go in this business, so you know the plants consolidate and they move and different things. And so then there's another big player, and these are the other plants. And so this next one is sort of what's left, you know, kind of everybody else, kind of all the in-between. And, you know, these are people that are selling direct to the retailers. These are people that are working as co-packers for people. This is a kind of a good depiction of really kind of what's out there. And you can see what we did was we overlaid the demand on top of that, and we, you know, the industry's done a really good job of being close to where the volume is and where the stores are, where the concentration of stores are. And you know, Chris talks about inventory, and you know where the volume is going to be, so you got to have the stuff ready to go in your 100 days of hell, right? That is about 150 miles from a store. I mean, the math is about the same for everybody. I mean, as you get more value-added products on your loads, you can expand that out a little bit. But you know, the model really is no different than it's ever been. So that's kind of what you sign up for when you ask that you want to be a national supplier in this business. So why use a co-packer? Well, there's a number of reasons, right? We talked about a few of those already. You could be capital constrained. You know, it's not cheap to put in plants. You can pick a number, $2 million, $3 million, depending on where you are, what you want to do. It's $750,000 a line kind of thing. Everybody knows what a loader costs. It's not inexpensive to do what we do. You could be like us. The next one is, you know, early stages of growing our brand of business. We want to grow the Harvest brand, okay? And so you've got to do a couple things. You have to have an offering, you have to have service, but you also have a network that can support that. And you can't just go out. We're not going to go out and buy 30 plants, right? So another reason why you're going to use a co-packer. For us and for many others, you know, people buy and sell businesses. We are, you know, part of our growth plan is through acquisitions. And so we talk to people all the time that, you know, we may want to use for a co-packer or do use as a co-packer that would make a nice acquisition target. Maybe that company's at a stage in their life where they're ready to be sold for whatever reason. Now gets into some of the real world things. So inefficient operations. So everybody who's been around these plants, everything doesn't always go to plan. Things move very quickly in that 100 days. Maybe your volume is over what the budget was. I've seen numbers. We like to plan 10-20% over in some cases, and sometimes that's still not enough. Chris talked about, you know, that at the end of the year, that number oftentimes is what the sales guy said it was going to be in a revenue top line, but it's, you know, a big part of this and a little part of this, and it was supposed to be opposite. So, you know, maybe you didn't plan for that. So it's not uncommon to go out and seek out co-packers or become a co-packer during the season or just prior to the season or maybe in preparation for the next season. Customer requests. It's also not uncommon that somebody in this room or anywhere for that matter falls behind, and a customer might come to you and say, "Hey, can you help me out in this area for a little bit?" So these are all reasons why you may be seeking out a co-packer. So why be a co-packer? So I tell folks that there's a whole range of co-packers. We talked about some of it today. Some folks just don't want to deal with the retailers. They just don't. They want to put soil and mulch in bags, and they're fine shipping it to the retailer, but they don't want to take that call, right? And we've all taken those calls. Maybe you want the freedom to produce to customers that you want to sell to. Maybe you have a sizable independent or small little niche area that you want to sell to, and maybe somebody comes along and tells you, "Hey, do this for me." So it gives you the freedom to do that. When you become very aligned with a national retailer, it's not uncommon for your culture and what you do to become that, right? To meet that expectation. Maybe you're new to the industry. You know, you really haven't established yourself. Maybe you want to be supplying retailers, but you know, it's not that easy to build the network and get in the door, right? We just finished line reviews this year. It's for all of you who attend those, it's not easy to get in there. So you sometimes need to establish yourself. I've seen this, and wasn't accustomed to this. Again, out on the West Coast, but out in the Mid-Atlantic states, there's a lot more land clearing that we do out here. And so maybe you're a land clearing guy, or maybe you have a little bulk operation, and a bagging line or something is a nice complement to that, and allows you to absorb your expenses over of more volume going out the door. Maybe you're a green waste composter, food composter, so looking for a means to get rid of that material after it's composted. Maybe you have a plant. Maybe you bought a plant. Maybe you bought a couple of plants, and they're underutilized in your current business. So you might want to be a co-packer, take on some business for a couple of years. We see that from time to time. And the last one, between awards and retailers, and I talk to our partners all the time about that, and we're not shy about talking about it. They're not shy. It's the reality of the business that 1 year, I've heard some of the guys in the business, you live or die by that 1 year at Home Depot, right? And so if you're in kind of an off year or something, maybe you want to utilize that capacity, and you're kind of hoping for it, or you want to reestablish yourself. So here's where we get into some expectations. This is really what we've learned at Harvest a little bit. I think it's been an ongoing process, and our business is maybe a little bit unique in that we had a big transformation 5-6 years ago when it was sold and then bought by Harvest. But some of the things that we, I will tell you that you could really sum it up in one word almost, and I hear it literally every day, and it's communication. And the co-packers that we use and to produce product for us, or in the little bit that we've co-packed for others in the last few years, it is all about communication and a lot of different means of communication. What we want to do is we want to try and document and put out what I call a kind of a statement of clarity, and to where you have a real true understanding of what expectations are and what you're doing, what the products are, to get rid of that ambiguity that always seems to come up during the 100 days of hell, right? So achievable expectations, that's an important one that we try and maintain. Things don't always go to plan, but you got to try and do your best. So, and then annual plans and really being communicative of that. And I hear that a lot too, that we're not always as good as we should be or our stakeholders want us to be. And then a support team. We've spent a lot on, Chris talked about investment, and we're trying to change the paradigm a little bit. And this is one area that we've really really invested a lot in. We have a full infrastructure just for contract manufacturing. Larkin Dupree, who's here with me this week, is our contract manufacturing manager. We have in-house, we call them buyer planners, but they're the ones that work with your support people day to day, hour by hour, and getting product on the ground, getting it made, getting POs, getting invoices, doing all the planning, everything that goes into it, getting all that accomplished. Dispatching, same thing. If we're dispatching and scheduling loads for a company, we do all that in-house now. We've really tried to develop a team that's got a lot of continuity. We're getting into multiple years now, which for Harvest is a big deal. We've got a lot of new people. We're people on our team have been more than 1 year, more than 2 years, and so we're starting to see the rewards of that. We do some other things too. We have a pretty good technical services director, so he's helping with formulations, he's helping with quality issues. He is very, very adept at going into the market that our co-packers are distributing into, and helping that stakeholder solve problems with the retailers, and it's just a very good service. He's been around for a long time. Communication, Chris talked about ERP. So we've, in the last 2 years, we've implemented a new ERP system that we use extensively for all of our business. Our co-packers have a portal where they're using the same system that we are. They see the same reports, everything. We try not to use Excel sheets. Sometimes people use them as tools, but we stick to our ERP system. And then, you know, there's a lot of things. I wanted to keep this to one slide, but, you know, business support, we do everything from marketing to, we do a little bit of sourcing of raw materials. You know, most folks like to do that themselves, but if you know, there's a synergy there, we're it's not uncommon for us to do that. Sourcing of not just packaging, but additives and different things like that as well. And then, last really point is the expectations of the co-packer, which is, you can see it's even a shorter list, because really I think you can take the list on the previous slide and apply it to the expectations of the co-packer. So, you know, really what it is, it's communication, okay? But it's also a shared vision. We can't be the company that we want to be with, you know, approximately 45% of our business is through co-packers if we don't work with companies that share our vision, or at least can't adapt to that vision. And so that's a very, very important for us, you know, trusted like-minded partners and achievable expectations. You know, we spend a lot of time now when we're talking with our contract manufacturers, Larkin and his team, in really truly understanding what the expectation is and those contingency plans. Okay, well, here's the number, and here's what it is at 110, here's what it is at 120%, and making sure that we're working through those contingencies. And then, you know, the operational commitment. You know, I know how hard it is, you know, May 10th, to get people to come in on a Saturday. Inventories, you know, you saw the curve on Chris's sheet, on his slide. Inventory's getting low. Orders don't seem to be dropping off. You know, the combination of inventory and your available capacity is lower than what the demand is. And it's a bad place to be, right? We've all been there. You know, having a partner that you can go and say, hey, listen, I need you to pick up a Saturday or whatever the case might be, that's an important thing for a co-packer. Consistent quality. You know, it's we are dealing with processing and variable materials, but, you know, there's certain sideboards that we work within, right? And just had a conversation yesterday with one of our partners and on quality. We stood out in front of the hotel and looked at mulch. And so it's just communicating that and being on the same page and you know, maintaining that for the whole year. And then, of course, being adaptable to the request. So this is a real interesting business in that when you start thinking about it, we're really on the wrong side of the line. So we're expected to have, you know, all this inventory on the ground. They don't tell you how much, right? You got to figure that out yourself. They don't tell you when it's going to start. They don't tell you how it's going to flow, but you better have it, right? And be adaptable if it's 40% over on a certain item. And so to be a co-packer, you really need that. That needs to be pushed all the way through. And so those are things that you really got to be focused on. And again, communication, awareness of issues. So I think that that's my last slide, and we're going to go right to questions and comments. So I'll leave that up there. Wow, that was easy.
Yeah.
That was thorough.
Oh, I don't. Overwhelmed. There's one.
I have a question for Chris. How often do you revisit your forecast as a team and then adjust it, your plans?
At least monthly, and it really depends on the time of the year. So, you know, during the spring, we look at it at least twice a month. And we rerun the production plan as well, but we don't necessarily publish it so much as really try and make sure that what we're planning on producing is still aligning with the sales trends that are evolving in the new forecast. So it's variable, and honestly, we're still trying to figure that part out.
Any other questions?
How many tow packing plants do you have across the U.S. versus mobile plants?
Sorry, what?
How many tow packing plants versus mobile?
Well, for us, in terms of volume, we're about 55% our plants, 45% co-packers. But in terms of number of sites, we have 3 company-owned harvest sites in the mid-Atlantic states. And this year, Larkin 14 is where we're at right now with contract manufacturers. We had, I believe we used 17 last year, and we used as high as 20 that I know of.
How do you manage your contract expectations? You're responsible for their pack. How do you monitor that to avoid weights and measures or other issues?
Yeah, good question. So we use the same criteria for sampling weights and measures as we do with any of our plants. So those expectations don't change. And our quality technical services director monitors that. And then from a product quality standpoint, we're out actually at those plants more than you would think. Even the ones that we have contract manufacturers that do less than 100,000 bags, and we'll even try and get to those sites at least once or twice a year. Somebody from the team will be out there to look at finished goods and kind of look at, we'll try and do that after the first of the calendar year as pre-pack starts to build, so you can get a pretty good idea of what's on the ground. Yep.
Chris, how far back do you go?
To dirt. So I came in.
You're monitoring your figures.
Oh, it depends on how much data we have. But I mean, older data tends to be less relevant because sometime in the last 5 years, a package size has changed. I mean, you know, there's only a certain lifespan that you have these products. But you know, 3 or 4 years is pretty ideal. A couple, especially in new geographies, is not very useful.
Have you had any success in predicting market and response to different packages, like more people are going to one cubic foot?
No, and that in our company, that wouldn't be an operations thing that we tried to achieve. That would be outside.
He didn't hear
the question. Was, have you had any success, or what are you doing about making new events like movement to one cubic foot package as a new trend?
Yeah, so maybe like a new product introduction that might feed off another, that sort of thing, is not something in our silo that we would be trying to predict. It's just not information that we have. That's where that connection, that sales and operations connection, is so important, because we want those guys to tell us what they think is going to happen. They're introducing the product. I mean, you would think that they would understand, they would have expectations and be able to give us what the expectations would be. I think probably what you said just scared everybody in the room that depends on bag deliveries and lives on that. I mean, conceptually, yeah, love it. But I think that there is such a difference or continuum of technical abilities amongst vendors and amongst us customers of those guys, that I think that making that connection is extremely, extremely tough. Again, I think it's ideal. And I think we're all thinking about how to get linked better, furnish better information to the folks that furnish bags to us. But it's only, I can tell you, it's only conceptual for us. Great idea, though.
Chris, when you guys see the training materials going up, how long do you guys actually go before you react to those? Buying additional bags, bringing in additional material? You're looking at your sales, which actually budgeted, and you see the increase. How
well,
do you usually go before you say, you know, this is not going on, you know, it's not early?
Well, it. Yeah, Well, it's really all that stuff is highly situational. So if it's fall and you're ending up the year with a lot of inventory anyway. Yeah, springtime. We would move on that very quickly. Yeah. No more quickly than that. I mean, I think as soon as we figured out that the inventory that we have and the capacity that we have to replenish with is getting. It's going inside the replenishment cycle and where we want to be in terms of stock status, we're gonna react to it then.
What about your empty bag? What do you guys typically?
I mean, yeah. Well, I mean, that's like I was saying early on. If there's something we relax, and I think probably everybody in the room does, it's inventories, because really in our business, what insurance do we have other than having stuff either in the bag or bags ready to fill with something? So, we're really trying to connect better the forecast with production with bags, but we're like anybody else. We're gonna hedge on the fat side. On bags, everything else being well, sure. I mean, lead times. If you're wrong and it's spring and you're low on bags, it's a terrible place to be. So that's, you know, all the old habits just keep coming out, right?
What fall starts?
Huh?
Is there any fall starts to avoid?
I don't know what you mean.
Bad data that leads you down a wrong path.
Well, I think so, but the whole idea is in this process is to not, even though you're refining and improving the data on the front end so that the results that you get out on the back end are better, I mean, you can't take that as gospel. You still got to compare that against your history and your expectations and other things to see if it's still valid and makes sense. So yeah, I think part of the process is getting bad signals and then figuring out why before you act on them.
This question is for Chris. How close did you come to actually meeting the forecast this year?
In terms of the revenue budget,
yes.
We exceeded it slightly, and it was a fairly, wasn't really conservative, let me just put it that way. So in terms of the expectations of the global amount of sales, it was very, very close. But I mean, it is year in and year out, unless you just have one of those springs, wet springs that won't quit, or some other anomaly that takes place. It's kind of amazing how close they come on an aggregate level.
Any questions for Ken on figuring your costs? For rent? On co-packing? Gentlemen, we thank you.